Well, brethren, Pentecost is coming up tomorrow, as we all know, and it is one of the seven annual holy days of God. And as such, it has a unique place in God's plan of salvation. The Jews consider Pentecost the conclusion of Passover, and they relate the giving of the law, of course, to a part of the meaning of this day. And they celebrate it on a fixed date, which, of course, we don't agree with, but they celebrate it from their perspective. But as Christians, all of us sitting in the audience today, we understand that it's the anniversary of the founding of the church. So Pentecost introduced to the world a brand new group of people. People who later on at Antioch were called Christians. It's an interesting title and an interesting name. Because in our day and age, Christian has become watered down. It's something different than what you read in the Bible. But for those of us who certainly follow God's way of life, the biblical perspective of Christianity has not lost its meaning. It identifies who we are and how we should act. There's a stark difference between who we are and everyone else in the world. Not that we're better, but there's a stark difference in what God expects of us. In fact, you could say that the difference between a Christian and the rest of the world is like light and darkness. Light and darkness. I want you to consider the following story with that particular introduction in your mind. I often read an online publication called the Asian Journal. Now, part of my responsibilities in ministerial services is working with senior pastors who serve in some parts of the world, various parts of the world. Mr. David Baker is the senior pastor. His pastorate goes from, you think Montana's a big pastorate, his pastorate goes from India to the Philippines. Now, if you look on a map, that's a good part of the world. You know, China and India alone, and then, of course, all the other parts that he is responsible for. We've had amazing growth. Actually, 2 years ago when he became the senior pastor, we had no one in India. We're now going to have a feast this year in India, and we have 60 members in India. Now, that's not a lot compared to a billion people, but 60 members and five congregations in the last 2 years. So it's been quite incredible, and of course, there's a lot more there as well. But in reading the Asian Journal, because of the interest in Asia, I pick up various articles. I'd like to relate an article to you that's dated March the 8th, 2008. The article is about a lady named Jed Tsai. Jed Tsai. Her first name is Jed, J-E-D, and her last name is Tsai, S-Y. She's a Filipino. She was married to a Chinese national. He's from Taiwan. And this is what happened to her, and this is her story. And I relate this to you for a very particular reason. Here's the story that I picked up from the Asian Journal, March the 8th, 2008. Female inmate Jed Tsai, who's been accused of drug trafficking, confessed to almost losing her sanity while doing time in the cramped, overcrowded detention facility in Ma'a Jail. Ma'a Jail is in Davao City in the Philippines. Davao City is located in the southern part of the island of Mindanao, which is the southern extreme of the Philippines. With over 100 other female inmates, Jed and company had to cope with and squeeze in three small individual cells with little ventilation and light, and some of them even sleeping in shifts. For Jed, nighttime was the hardest, because aside from the congested jail, she always thought about her daughter, whom she had to leave behind. Jed's Chinese husband is a drug trafficker. When he fled, she was the one arrested and later charged. Now, the article goes on to describe what a dramatic difference this one woman has made in the jail in Davao. Now, to give you a little background, Davao City is the center of a lot of the drug trafficking in Asia. And there's just a lot going on there. The mayor of Davao City is a man by the name of Duarte. And Mayor Duarte came into power as mayor by announcing he would get rid of all drug trafficking in the area. So now when you fly into Davao City, my wife and I were there for the feast 3 years ago. You fly to Davao City. Before you land, you know, normally you get one of these landing cards and you fill out for customs and all of that. You get a landing card before you land in Davao. On one side of the card, it says, "Welcome to Davao." On the back side, it says, "If you are a drug dealer or if you're bringing drugs, you will be shot." And that's your welcome to Davao. He has declared martial law, and they have the death squads that roam the city. And if they find anyone dealing drugs or anyone with drugs, they kill them and leave their bodies so that others will see it the next day. It obviously has had a dramatic effect on drugs in this particular city. But this is the city where Jed Tsai lives with her husband. Her husband, Alan Tsai, is a Chinese national who is a drug trafficker. There's a bit more to the story. Jed Tsai is a member of the United Church of God. She was arrested on New Year's Day 2005, has been in jail for 3.5 years without a trial. She is completely innocent of the charges and had no idea what her husband was doing. But because he escaped, she was the one arrested and now sits in jail in Davao City in the Philippines. The story goes like this. On New Year's Eve, 2004, Jed Tsai and her 3-year-old daughter were sitting in a restaurant waiting for her husband, Alan, to come for dinner. Alan was late by several hours, so she and her daughter finally went home. This was not unusual because her husband would often disappear for days at a time, and it wasn't unusual for him not to show up, so she simply went home. Jed Tsai grew up in the Church of God. She married an individual who was not in the church, an individual who had, obviously, a bit more to his past than she was fully aware of. But her name was on all of the documents owning the various properties that they had bought over the years, and therefore, of course, she was the one left behind. But he didn't show up on New Year's Eve. So the next day, New Year's Day 2005, the PDEA knocked on her door. PDEA, the Philippines Drug Enforcement Agency, knocked on her door, came in, searched her place, announced that they were arresting her and taking her away. She had to quickly call for her mother to come and take care of her daughter as they took her off to jail. It turned out that there had been a shootout the night before at the warehouse owned by the Tsai family. They were into, they were making snack foods that were shipped all over the Philippines and other places, and were quite successful. It turned out this was a front for the making of shabu, which is the main ingredient in methamphetamine, and it was going all over the country. So there was a shootout the night before. 6 Chinese nationalists were killed, but they could not find Alan Tsai, who was the head of this operation. He somehow escaped, disappeared. He hasn't been seen or heard from since that time, not even by his wife or, of course, the family. But they arrested Jed, took her off to jail, locked her up, and she asked why. They said, because your name is, you are one of the owners of this property. Therefore, we are arresting you. And she sits in jail to this day, 3.5 years later. Mr. Makarig, who's the pastor of the Davao City congregation, wrote this to me back in 2005. He says, right now, Jed is like the biblical Joseph in prison. Not only has she improved the women's prison by providing electric fans for all the rooms and mattresses for all to sleep on, but she is respected, trusted, and looked highly upon by jail wardens and inmates. She has free access to use her own cell phone. She has her video player and TV and is able to watch our sermon videos at will. She is also working as an accountant. She is a CPA in the city jail's cooperative enterprise. She works at an air-conditioned office and uses their computers. Thus, she presently finds safety and fulfillment there. The article that I read to you in the beginning goes on to focus on Jed Tsai as someone who made a tremendous difference for the women in this one prison and all that she had done. And they showed a picture of her. This was on the internet in this particular issue of the newspaper, a picture of her crying and sobbing because, of course, of her daughter and what she had had to leave behind. 3.5 years later, she has still not gone to trial. I asked Mr. McArig to give me an update as I had found this article about her, and he wrote to me that there had been a trial date set back in April of this year, finally, and it had been postponed, and now it's been postponed again until August before she will actually go to trial. There are no witnesses, there is no evidence, there's nothing against her, but the government, the city, holds her in jail. There's a very simple point to this, not only that, of course, we pray for one of God's children, one who's suffering immensely with her daughter. Now, 3.5 years later, her daughter was 3, she's now 6.5. We met her mother and her daughter back in 2005 at the Feast of Tabernacles, where, of course, Jed had been a member for all of her life in that particular area. But she stands out. In fact, the interesting part of this article, there's a picture in this newspaper of Jed Tsai and the deputy mayor of Davao. giving her an award for what she's done in prison. The same people who put her in prison because of the drugs and because of what had gone on. She is truly a light to all those around her. Not because of what she says, but because of what she does. She exemplifies the light that we call Christianity, and not the darkness we see in the world around. Turn with me to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians, the second chapter, is a scripture that speaks to this point very eloquently by the Apostle Paul. Philippians chapter 2, let's begin in verse 14. Philippians 2, verse 14. Do all things without murmuring and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God, without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. Lights in the world. This verse expresses something in a way that I think we can all understand. We know how important light is. You know, it's amazing to me. You can be in the darkest room and a very small light makes a huge impact in a dark room. You can be driving down a road, and you know, a road can be very dark and suddenly come to an area where there are lights. It's just an incredible difference. It's amazing what a difference light makes. You can imagine the Apostle Paul writing these verses and having something similar in mind. The Greek word for lights here is phostar, phostar. It means an illuminator. And this phrase can actually be translated luminaries. You shine as luminaries. Now, we think of a luminary as a great person, a dignitary. And this is what Paul is using this to get across a point to the Philippians of what Christianity is all about. Young's literal translation translates this verse this way, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God, unblemished in the midst of a generation crooked and perverse, among whom you do appear as luminaries in the world. Luminaries in the world. Great people in the world. Now, again, you would say, well, Christians aren't really great people in the world. I'm wondering if our perspective is indeed the same as God's. And when you're talking about a light that shines in darkness, points of light that make it clear who you are and how they shine so brilliantly in the midst of a very dark world. The New Living Translation translates it this way. You are to live clean, innocent lives as children of God in a dark world full of crooked and perverse people. Let your lives shine brightly before them. So here's the concept of light versus darkness, of a point of light, of you and me as Christians and the impact we have on the world today. I'm not sure we fully comprehend the depth of that impact when you see it from God's perspective. A number of years ago, the senior President Bush established a program that he called Points of Light. And the purpose of this program was to recognize people who made a difference in communities and, you know, different things and different issues. Could have been firemen, could have been an EMT, could have been a nurse, could have been a doctor. These were all people that were not well known, but who were a point of light. And they had the like a map of the United States, and they had these points of lights blinking in all of these areas. In the 4 years of President Bush's presidency, they gave out 1,000 certificates as points of light, individuals who impacted others by the way they lived their lives, by what they had done. Now, that idea of points of light. There's also a book, it's actually a two-volume work that I picked up, or actually didn't pick it up, but actually read a bit of it here a couple of months ago, and it's called Making a Difference. It's an interesting book, two-volume work, because it's all about nurses. All about nurses. We became interested in this to some degree because our middle daughter decided to go back to school and become a nurse and just finished and is now ready to become an RN. But the idea of the nurses who are unnamed, unsung, but who sit in hospitals at night and sit up with those who are dying, maybe the only person there with a child as the child dies, or another person who has no family and they're there with them, and no one notices, but they make a difference. And they shine as a light, making a difference. My wife and I had the wonderful opportunity to visit Jordan and Jerusalem, Israel, during the Spring Holy Days. We actually have a project in Jordan that's really beginning to develop, and it's quite interesting, this Jordanian project. We have volunteer teachers that we're assigning to schools in Jordan. The Jordanian government, actually through a foundation, is paying for this. And they're funding this, and we provide them. They want our students. They want our volunteers. This is the same group of people that knew of the Ambassador Foundation, knew from Ambassador College 15 to 20 years ago, and they still remembered us. And some of the same people that we're dealing with today were those that the foundation dealt with at that time. And here's the Princess Sarvath, who is was the wife of the Crown Prince of Jordan for many, many years, and still, of course, a part of the royal family. She's the one that heads up the foundation. And we met with her, and we asked her, what is there so special about our students? Because we have two there now. We're going to send four or five this next year, and the foundation will support that. Well, what is so special? She said, well, it's interesting that a lot of Christian groups, and she knows exactly who we are and exactly what we believe, so a lot of Christian groups will come to Jordan under false pretenses. They'll come pretending they're not going to be proselytizing. They're not going to be trying to get people to convert. And she says, they come over, and before you know it, that's what they're doing. She says, your people come over, they don't have to preach anything, but they convict people by the way they live their lives. And she said, we'll take all of them you can send. They are a wonderful, wonderful example of what we see as true Christianity. And it was so good to hear what they had to say and what they felt about our young people. But we were there to visit them and to visit the project and to visit the people involved. As a side trip and a part of that, since we were so close to Jerusalem, we did visit Jerusalem. And we visited the Holocaust Museum. Now, this is the premier, there are a lot of Holocaust museums around the world, but as you can imagine, this is the premier museum to the Holocaust. It's called Yad Vashem, Yad Vashem. Turn with me to Isaiah chapter 56. This is where the name Yad Vashem comes from. It's obviously Hebrew, but it has a very particular meaning. It has something to do with, again, the direction I want to go here this afternoon. Isaiah chapter 56 in verse 5. The statement is made here, actually verse 4, for thus says the Lord to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths and choose what pleases me and hold fast my covenant. Even to them I will give in my house and within my walls a place and a name. Better than that of sons and daughters, I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. The term Yad Vashem, Yad means memorial or place, and Shem means name, so it's actually the memorial or the place of names. The place of names is Yad Vashem. And it gets this name for a particular reason. Now, we went to the museum one afternoon, and we thought, well, we'll go through the museum. It won't take that long. It took us almost 5 hours because there's so much. You wander through this and see so much, and it's so sobering. But then once you walk out of the main museum, you walk less than 100 yards, and there's another museum, a memorial. And you walk in the door. This is the Children's Memorial. You walk in the door, and it's like you're in a cave almost. And from horizon to horizon, it's as though you've stepped out into space. And you're surrounded by lights, blinking lights, all around you and all up the walls. And off to your left, you see the names of the children and their pictures flashed on the side of the wall. And then there's a monotone voice that reads the names of the children who died in the Holocaust. 1.5 million children died in the Holocaust. And this is the Children's Memorial. Each child is represented by a blinking light. And it's so incredibly moving to stand there and realize every light that blinks represents an innocent child who died in the darkness of evil. And it's just extremely impressive and extremely moving to walk out of there and to realize points of light and what points of light mean. In this case, innocent children. In the case of Christianity, God's people, who no doubt blink as God looks, in a world full of darkness. The title of my sermon, you might have guessed by now, is Points of Light, Being an Example to the World. And after visiting this museum, it really struck me what a wonderful analogy, what a tremendous symbol it is to picture the people of God as flashing lights, points of light from all over the world, from a jail in the Philippines to the forests of South America to the frozen lands of northern Canada. Points of light, people of God, who represent the most wonderful calling you could ever imagine. This concept of light and darkness is found in the Bible from beginning to end. In fact, the most significant and the very first symbol you find in the Bible is the fact or the act of light becoming available. The first thing God does in recreation is that light is made available to drown out the darkness. And you see this as an analogy. You see this as a statement from God, from Genesis 1 all the way to Revelation 22. And you see this one analogy that is so strong. Let's go back to Genesis 1. Look at what Genesis 1 tells us about this concept of light versus darkness. The people of God being points of light, being lights to the world, and of course the world being a world of darkness. Genesis 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We read through the scriptures, we have no doubt that God did not create the world in chaos. You know, God doesn't create something chaotic. He created the world and it had to be beautiful. The heavens and all that were in them must have been beautiful. An incredible scene. We know that God doesn't create the sun on the first day. It doesn't say he creates the sun on the first day. Nor is the sun created later on. The sun is there from the beginning. But there's no light penetrating to the earth at this point. Something happens after verse 1, and then we get to verse 2. The earth was without form and void. And notice what we see. Darkness was on the face of the deep. So the world goes from this beautiful, picturesque, wonderful place, no doubt, to one of darkness. And again, we can read the other scriptures, and we know there was a rebellion, and we know that Lucifer was kicked out. You know, he was kicked out, and darkness now reigns. Darkness now reigns. So then we find the story beginning in verse 3, where God recreates, reshapes, puts things back in their proper orbits and proper places so that man can be put on this earth. And what does he say? Then God said, first quote from God. First quote in the Bible from God Almighty is what? Let there be light. And there was light. God brings light to the world. This is the very beginning. Now you keep that in mind, and let's turn to John 1. John 1, and we find the next place where the concept of in the beginning is used. And this, of course, John 1, verse 1. Now, many of the commentaries do not miss the point of what Paul said in Philippians and what we read in Genesis and also what we read in John. This is a quote from one of the commentaries. It says, let there be light compares two examples. Paul's statement that Christians are the light to the world and the story of creation. Light was brought to a dark and chaotic world. In the same manner, Christians bring light to a dark and perverse world. It isn't coincidental that this analogy is used by both Paul and by Moses in writing the very beginning scriptures of the Bible. And then you come to John 1, verse 1. John 1, verse 1, you have, again, in the beginning. And what is central to this beginning, or this statement about the beginning? What is central? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. So we have the physical light that brings brightness to the world in Genesis 1, and now we have a spiritual reference to Jesus Christ as bringing light to the earth. We have a spiritual and a physical. Genesis 1, John 1. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it, or the darkness doesn't overcome it. Light cannot be destroyed by darkness, but darkness can be destroyed by light. Light can destroy darkness. It removes it. It disappears. It goes away. But darkness can never destroy light. Never destroy light. Christ brought the light that shines in the darkness, and darkness cannot overcome it, cannot apprehend it, the margin says. It says, there was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness to bear witness of the light, that all through him might believe. So John bears witness of what? That Jesus Christ brings the light. So the entire Bible is a message about the darkness of this world and the light that God brings. You know, you could summarize even the plan of salvation is what? It's to bring the light to the entire world. We read about New Jerusalem as a place where it is never dark. You see, there are all sorts of spiritual concepts here in what you and I are, and of course what Jesus Christ was as well. This man came for a witness to bear witness of the light that all through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which does what? Gives light to every man who comes into the world. Now you have a statement here in the book of John that salvation is for whom? Every single person. Will every person accept it? No, not likely. That's why we believe in God's holy days so profoundly. I had a discussion a few years ago with a gentleman who was one of the leaders of the Church of God Seventh Day. And we had a good relationship. They'd asked me even to come and teach a couple of classes in one of their schools. And I asked him, I said, well, what is the difference between what you believe and what we believe? And he said, well, of course, there's the U.S. and Britain. We don't accept that. We don't accept the holy days. And then he said something that I had not thought about, but if you think that they don't accept the holy days, you follow this line of thinking through and you'd realize that this is true. He said, we believe that today is the only day of salvation. There is no, quote, second resurrection as you teach. There is no future chance for anyone. And, of course, I asked him the obvious question that would come to my mind, having been to Africa. I said, you know, I've been to Africa, and there are millions. In fact, there were 25 million black Africans who died in the slave trade for 350 years. And these were individuals that worshiped trees and stones, and some today still. Never heard of Jesus Christ for hundreds of years. And you mean they're all doomed? And, of course, he gave the same answer that virtually every Protestant group will give. Well, God knows. God will take care of it. There's no answer to that question, except what? The last great day, the great white throne judgment that you and I celebrate every single year. The difference there is quite stark. But God offers salvation to all human beings, but not now. You and I are lights that shine in a very dark world. Why? Because Jesus Christ lives in us, who is the true light. Not because you're so great or I'm so great. Not that we are the greatest people on earth. You know, God didn't look around and say, well, I'm going to find the people that have the greatest character, and I'm going to put them in my church because they'll be the ones that will represent me well. He called individuals that he said will change their lives. Individuals that will change their very core and become Christian and reflect the light that Jesus Christ says he is the true light, or that John says here. I also find it interesting, if you go back to Matthew 4, that Jesus Christ began his ministry with this particular theme. In fact, Matthew records a prophecy that Christ quotes, identifying himself as the light. Matthew 4, there's an interesting story here. If you look back at the end of Matthew 3, you find Jesus Christ being baptized. One of the opportunities we had in this last trip was to visit a lot of these areas. You know, we had our whole list of things that we wanted to see, and in a very short period of time, we were able to see all of them. We crisscrossed Israel and crisscrossed Jordan, got arrested only once, I guess, during that period of time. That's another story, but we were all over trying to see all of these sites. And, of course, they take you to the place where Jesus Christ was baptized by John the Baptist. You know, which, again, whether it was there or not is irrelevant. It must have been somewhere near there because you see Christ comes from Galilee. Notice verse 13 of John 3. Comes from Galilee to John at the Jordan. So it's somewhere near Jerusalem. And from Jerusalem going over to the Jordan River is not a far distance. And no doubt somewhere in that general area, obviously coming down from Galilee, would have been where Christ was baptized. So he's baptized by John. Then chapter 4, he's led into the wilderness. And if you go to the area where they claim that Christ was baptized, you don't have to go far, and you're indeed in the wilderness. I mean, it's a desert wilderness area that surrounds that, both on the Jordanian side as well as on the Israeli side. So you can easily see how this would have happened, where Christ is baptized, he goes into the wilderness, he's there for 40 days and 40 nights, he's tempted by Satan. And then verse 12 of chapter 4, Christ comes back from the time in the wilderness, and he says he heard that John had been put in prison. He departed to Galilee. So he's somewhere in this wilderness area, somewhere not all that far from Jerusalem, and he goes all the way back up to Galilee. Now, this is very interesting. Why doesn't Christ begin his ministry in Jerusalem? During the first century, Jerusalem and in Judea was set up rather interestingly. You have the area of Judea, which is the southern part of the nation of Israel today, and it's called Judea. Then you have just north of Jerusalem a little ways, you've got a stretch called Samaria. It was primarily occupied by Gentiles by this time. And then you go a little further north, you get up near the Lebanon and Syrian border, and you have Galilee. Galilee. The religious center of that entire area was Jerusalem. Anything religious came out of Jerusalem. Nothing of value was going to come out of Samaria. That's a Gentile area. Nothing of value would ever come out of Galilee. So Jesus Christ ignores the religious center of that nation and goes to Galilee to begin his ministry. He had to go about, it must be about 70 miles north to get all the way up to the Sea of Galilee. And then beyond the Sea of Galilee, he's almost up to the Lebanon border. He's as far away from Jerusalem as you can possibly get and still be in this nation. That's where he's going to begin his ministry. There's a statement behind that as well, that it isn't going to begin from the religious center of Israel. It's going to begin somewhere else. And he quotes a prophecy. Notice verse 12. When Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he departed to Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, Nazareth is a little bit south and west of the Sea of Galilee, not on the Sea of Galilee. He leaves Nazareth, goes to Capernaum. Capernaum is on the Sea of Galilee, on the very northern side of the Sea of Galilee, which is by the sea, in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, which were the tribes that had originally given that area, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, and notice the prophecy. This is from Isaiah chapter 9. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. There is a route that went from northern Jordan all the way to the Mediterranean Sea that came right across the Golan Heights and right across the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. So that was called the way of the sea. That's the way the trade routes went during that particular time. So it says, the prophecy says, the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, from the Jordanian side all the way to the sea, it's not really that terribly far, because it's not that far across Israel, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness saw a great light, and upon those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. So Christ goes into what would be considered the darkest part of Israel. You know, the Jews around Jerusalem felt, we have it all. We've got the light. We're God's people. We've got the temple. We've got everything. Christ begins his ministry in the darkest part of Israel, the darkest part of the land that was surrounded by Gentiles. He goes to Galilee, the northern part of Galilee, and he begins there. And what does he do? Verse 17, from that time Jesus began to preach and to say, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. He began his ministry from there. And yet the Jews would have said, well, nothing of any religious value could ever come from there. And you even have some of those comments later on. But this is the darkest part to fulfill the prophecy that the light has dawned. Christ is bringing a message that isn't just for the Jews, even though Christ preaches to Israel during the 3.5 years of his ministry. But the message ultimately isn't for Israel alone. It is for the whole world. And so this light, this point of light, dawns in northern Israel up on the Lebanese-Syrian border, the Golan Heights, a very contested area today, in an area north of the Sea of Galilee. He begins his ministry in probably the most remote, the furthest away from Jerusalem you could get to make a point and to fulfill the prophecy. The light has dawned. Notice again the symbol of a light. The symbol of a light. Then look at Matthew 5. After Christ begins his ministry, you have the selection of some of the disciples. You have healing that takes place. Verse 23, so Christ goes all about Galilee, Matthew 4:23, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease among the people. So this goes on in that entire area. And then chapter 5, he's still in the Galilee area. Seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain, and when he was seated, his disciples came to him. So Christ chooses a mountain, and there's a place today called the Mount of Beatitudes, which is between Capernaum and going around the southern part, the western side of the Sea of Galilee, and just south of the Sea of Galilee, or southern part of the Sea of Galilee, there's a mountainside that they claim. This is the Mount of Beatitudes. Now, whether it is or not is irrelevant to me, but if you look around the Sea of Galilee, there's several of these like hilltops and mountains that look right down on the Sea of Galilee. Now, the one in particular that they've chosen does seem to be very likely, because if you're standing on the top of it, you can look straight across. And you can't see the Sea of Galilee until you come to the edge and look down. And it comes down, and then it makes into a little plateau that eases right down to the sea. And it would make for a beautiful amphitheater type of a setup for what Christ would have given. Now, again, whether it is or not is irrelevant, but it's somewhere in that area. And he begins to talk to his disciples and then the crowds that begin to gather. What does he say? Look at verse 13. You, talking to his disciples, are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. It's very interesting that the Dead Sea produces a tremendous amount of salt. And it's very good salt, shipped all over the world. But there's a portion of the Dead Sea which is filled with a substance called bitumen. And any salt that comes from that part of the Dead Sea is called bituminous salt. And it's useless. It has no real value for salt. Here's what the commentary says. It says, there was a species of salt in Judea which was generated at the Dead Sea, hence called bituminous salt, easily rendered vapid and of no other use but to be spread in a part of the temple to prevent slipping in wet weather. This is probably what our Lord alludes to in this place. In other words, the salt there was of no value except to be taken to the temple area. The temple area has a lot of stone, can be very slippery when it's wet, and just like we do today, they spread it out so that it would give you traction and you wouldn't slip. So therefore, Christ says it's of no value except to be trampled underfoot by men. It's useless salt. Useless salt. In verse 14, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men, what? That they may see your good works. What is the light? What comes from a Christian? Good works. You know, it's not difficult to understand. This identifies the light. This identifies you as a Christian. Not because of what you say you are, but what you do and what you are identifies you as a Christian and identifies you as truly a light to the world. Just as the Bible is filled with the analogy of Christianity and goodness being light, it's also filled with the opposite of that, and that is evil and darkness are always associated together. In fact, the ultimate penalty or the ultimate reward, you might say, for Satan and the demons is what? Outer darkness. Outer darkness. Matthew 8, verse 12, identifies the reward of those who are not in the kingdom of God as being a place of outer darkness. Matthew 8, verse 12, but the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So we see darkness is related to evil. We're told that Satan and his demons are the rulers of darkness. Paul uses that term. And we're also told that you and I, when we were called into the truth, were called from what? out of darkness. So the world, the evil, the world as controlled by Satan is called darkness. Christianity and those who follow God are referred to as light, reflecting the light of Jesus Christ. The analogy is just so consistent throughout the Scriptures. Sometimes I believe it's a little hard for us to understand exactly how dark, dark really is, because we're often not exposed to total darkness. Throughout the Middle Ages, one of the great punishments for people, they were political prisoners as well as other reasons, they were brought into the castles. And where were they put for punishment? They were put in the dungeons. And a part of that punishment was because it would be totally dark. And that was a part of the punishment, put them in total darkness. I guess I experienced this at least to a greater degree than I've ever done before in Ghana, actually. Where in Ghana, along the coast along the coast, there are several slave castles. These are huge fortresses that were built by the British, the Dutch, and the Portuguese in order to house the slaves for a period of time until they could come and pick them up. And again, this is where you find out that it was 350 years. They estimate 25 million died in the slave trade. These are the ones that died in the slave trade. These are not the ones that made it through. These are the ones that died. And it would often would be one tribe would conquer another tribe, and they would sell their warriors to the British, the Portuguese, or the Dutch for guns or other things. And so they have these monuments. The slave castles are kept as monuments of the slave trade. Because that's where they would stay. And these slave castles were built with stone that was brought from Europe. I mean, these things are gigantic with this stonework sitting on the coast of Ghana. And it's a virtual city on the top, but underneath are the dungeons. Underneath are the dungeons. As you go in and they take you on a tour, there's actually a plaque that you first see. And it says, "We, the people of Africa, apologize to our fellow Africans for our part in the slave trade," where they recognized they were a part of that as well. It wasn't just the white Europeans that came in. They were the ones that were also a part of it. And then there's this plaque. But then they take you down to the dungeon. And they had the women's dungeon and they had the men's dungeon. And you walk into this room, and they've got some lights in it now. And then they turn out the lights. And it is absolute total dark. It is the eeriest feeling. There is no people could be standing within a foot of you, and you wouldn't know they were there. You couldn't see anything. You could feel the darkness. And they said, "This is the way it was for the slaves for 3 months at a time." And food would be thrown in, and a little light would be let in to put water in to wash them down. They couldn't sit down. They were shoulder to shoulder standing for this period of time. And as one would die, they would pull out the bodies and the others would stand. And as the guide would say, he said, "Feel the substance of the floor you're standing on. It's not quite the same as the concrete everywhere else. It has not a give to it, but it seems more flexible." He says, "That's because of the human waste that was built up and trampled down for hundreds of years in these places has formed the floor of that. This is where they kept them to debilitate them, to weaken them so they could be then put on the ships without having a problem." Darkness is so total, it is incredible. You can feel it in your skin. It's the most eerie experience I've ever had. But the feeling of darkness. Darkness is the opposite of the light we're talking about. That's the world we live in. I don't believe we honestly see the world as being darkness. Because it's so easy, even as a Christian, to embrace the world. We read all the scriptures about coming out of the world, but we still have to live in this world, and that's true. But when you think of the world as being that total darkness, except for these points of light, then you begin to get a perspective that I think is very different. When I was in that dungeon, I thought about, this is the way God sees the world. And it's an eerie, strange feeling because it is so dark. Over the years as a pastor, and the greatest joy that I've had in my lifetime has been getting to know the people of God in various places around the world. And I've identified in my own mind individuals that I see over the years. I still see them in my mind from many years gone by who were points of light, who were true examples of Christianity. They weren't perfect, but they were examples of Christianity. One of the first individuals that I came across in my ministry was a man that still to this day stands out so vividly in my mind. He died in the mid-70s. But in 1972, I was sent to Atlanta, Georgia. As I said, I was sitting in a Bible study one Friday night in Big Sandy, Texas, and a list was announced that, well, these are the individuals that are going into the ministry, you know, the field ministry. And my name was read, and I'm going to Atlanta, Georgia. Well, I mean, that's the first I heard about it. First I knew about it. Nobody asked me. Nobody told me. Well, this is where you're going. And I was very happy to go and very happy to have gone to Atlanta. But when I got to Atlanta, I was assigned to work with an elder there, a man by the name of Bill Wilkinson. He's the first person that I really remember so vividly in a congregation that really was a light, not only to the congregation, but everyone around him. And he was such a humble man. Here I am, 22 years old. I'm a ministerial assistant or ministerial trainee. He's the elder there, and he's going visiting with me, and he would defer to me. And I would try to defer to him, and he would defer back to me. And he would sit there quiet and make me conduct the visit because he wanted me to learn, and he wanted to teach me. He was probably in his early 50s. He was he sold building supplies. He worked for a building supply company in Atlanta, was very successful. One day I was over at his home, and I would go to his home, and we would get together, and we'd go out visiting. And I went to his home, and he said, let me show you something. He took me down in his basement. And in his basement, he had all of this woodworking equipment. And he said, this is a company that I started to help the church. And I thought, well, what do you mean, help the church? He said, well, I started this company, and every nickel of it I put back into the church. So I either give it in a holy day offering, or I use it to help people in the church. So just something that I started on my own. And he made this molding for in homes. It's this custom molding, different types of molding. Individuals say, well, I want this type of molding, and he would make it in his shop, and he would sell it. And his company didn't mind him doing that. He did it on the side, he and his sons. It had all in his basement. I thought, well, that's remarkable. That's remarkable that he did that. Then a part of my job as one of the new ministers in the area was to visit a lot of the widows and the orphans and to make sure they're being taken care of, or the widows and the needy, and make sure that if we needed to do something for them. And I'd go and visit these individuals. I'd say, you know, Mrs. So-and-so, well, what can we do for you? And she would say, well, I don't need anything. Mr. Wilkinson was already here, and he bought groceries for me. He brought me this. He brought me that. So, okay, well, that's fine. I go to visit another one. He says, so what can we do for you? I said, well, Mr. Wilkinson was here last week, and he paid my rent. I couldn't pay it. He took care of that for me. And over the period of time, in that period of time, he was virtually the third tithe program for that entire church. And it was because he quietly wanted to do something, and it was something he could do. What a wonderful light he was, and what a very sad day when he died suddenly. In, I think it was 1974, night after the Day of Atonement. I'll never forget getting the phone call the next day that he had suddenly died. But what a wonderful light he was. You know, and I go through the years and all the places that I've served. My wife and I were privileged to serve for almost 20 years in Houston. Almost 20 years in one place as a pastor. There's just so many faces. I actually think of a couple of men who just really stood out in my mind over the years and the stories they used to tell me. One was named Arthur and the other was named Huey. They're also both deceased now. Neither one of them had their families in the church. But they were often the first ones at church, always wanted to help in any way they could. Well, Arthur was this huge man. He was probably, I don't want to compare him to anyone because I've already said huge. So, but he was a big man. And he, you know, he was probably 6'3", 6'4", and just a big man. But he couldn't see. He wore glasses that were as thick as a Coke bottle. And he's trying to hand out songbooks, and he's putting it in your face, and he's putting it in your stomach. But he's giving out songbooks. He wants to help. He's setting up chairs, about as crooked as you've ever imagined chairs. But he wants to set up chairs. And then his friend, and his family wasn't in the church, but his friend was named Huey. And Huey was about 5'2" and weighed about 120 pounds. So here was Huey and Arthur, fast friends, always together, the oddest couple you've ever seen. But they loved the church. It was their family. They always wanted to serve. And every year after the feast, I'd always go and visit Huey and Arthur and just to find out what was their feast like. And they told me the most hilarious stories about the feast. They always went to Big Sandy and camped. And they used to drive, Huey drove this big old car, and they used to get a big U-Haul that had the double axle on it just to put all their things in. They had to take their beds, they had to take everything up to put in their tent up in Big Sandy. And so I'd go and ask, and Huey couldn't hear. He was almost deaf. And Arthur couldn't see. He was virtually blind. So Huey would drive, and Arthur would try to tell him where they're going, which he had no clue where they were going, but he was telling them. And of course, they knew the way to Big Sandy. You go right up Highway 59 out of Houston. So they have this big U-Haul, and I went one year to visit them after the feast, and they were telling me the story of what happened at the feast. I said, well, what happened this year? Oh, you'll never believe what happened this year, Mr. Franks. So what happened? Tell me what happened, Huey. And he says, well, we're driving up to Big Sandy like we normally do, and Highway 59 is, Houston is as flat as it can be. The highest point in Houston is an overpass. You know, it's just really flat. And but you get a little ways out of Houston, and you get into the rolling hills as you get into East Texas. And so he said, we got up to the top of this hill, and we were coming down the hill, and I kind of glanced beside me, and I said, Arthur, there's somebody trying to pass us going down the hill. And Arthur said, well, that can't be. Nobody could be passing us. Well, why would it be stupid to pass us going down a hill? But Arthur couldn't see. He looked right. He said, I don't see anything, Huey. He said, oh, yeah, there's somebody coming up on our side. And he says, Arthur, it's not a vehicle. There's a trailer, and nobody's driving it. It's coming up beside us. And so Arthur says, well, I can't see it, Huey. Where is it? So pretty soon, this U-Haul trailer is along beside them. It had come loose from their vehicle and was going down the hill side by side with them. And so, fortunately, it crashes on the side of the road, and they go pick it up. I mean, they're telling me this. I mean, the two individuals were a menace to society, but they were dedicated to serving God. They loved God's people and loved the feast. And it just showed wherever they went. But they were always there, always with a smile, always shining as the people of God. When I used to visit a lot of new people up in New England, we had a lot of new people come to the church back in the 80s, and I would always visit with them, and I would think in my mind, well, who do I want them to see first when they go to church on the Sabbath? You know, not that everybody, you know, anybody they couldn't see, but I always wanted them to see one person. I said, okay, when you go to church in Boston, be sure you see Larry Levine. Larry Levine was this short Frenchman who always had this big smile and would throw his arms open. And he says, "Salutation or greetings and salutations, my friend," with a big smile. And he greeted everybody like that that came into the church. And I said, he said, go meet Larry Levine. I don't care if you meet no one else Sabbath, be sure you meet him. Because he lights up the place. He is a light of God's way of life. God has given us the greatest blessing you could possibly imagine. And we have to reflect that light. We have to light up the place. We have to light up wherever we are. Not because we have big personalities, but because we reflect the light of Jesus Christ. Notice a couple of examples. Look at Acts chapter 9. Not only are there modern-day examples, and I could go on and on, and I'm sure you could as well, of the people you've known over the years who reflected that light, who shined in a dark corner, who shined wherever they were, because of their character and who they were. Acts chapter 9 is a story of a lady named Tabitha, or Dorcas. And notice what it says about her. Verse 36, she wasn't an apostle. She wasn't a leader of any kind, as far as I can tell, in the church of God. But she made an impact on so many people's lives. And I simply say, which is more important, to be someone who leads or someone who impacts others in such a dramatic way? Look at what happened with her. Verse 36, at Joppa there was a certain disciple named Tabitha, which is translated Dorcas. This woman was full of good works and charitable deeds, which she did. But it happened in those days that she became sick and died. When they had washed her, they laid her in an upper room. And since Lydda was near Joppa, and the disciples had heard that Peter was there, they sent two men to him, imploring him not to delay in coming to them. This was a significant death in that area, this one lady. Then Peter arose and went with them, and when he had come, they brought him to the upper room. And notice this, all the widows stood by him weeping. Whom did she serve? The less fortunate. Whom did she light up for? The less fortunate. They were weeping, showing the tunics and garments which Dorcas had made while she was with them. So here's the story, and of course the rest of the story. Peter raises her from the dead, or she's raised from the dead. She was truly a saint. Now, she's referred to as a saint here. And it says in verse 41, Peter called all the saints and widows and presented her alive. What was so special about her? What did she light up the area with? Her good works. There's an interesting translation in the Young's literal translation of Ephesians 2, verse 10. Ephesians 2, verse 10, which says we were created for good works. Here's what the Young's literal translation says. For we are God's masterpiece, Ephesians 2, verse 10. He has created us anew in Christ Jesus so that we can do the good things He planned for us long ago. When God designed the church, and when God talks of Christianity, this is what He's talking about. He designed us for good works, to represent His way of life, whether you ever say a word, whether you ever preach a sermon, whether you ever conduct a visit, whether you ever do any of that. Your good works identify who you are. Christianity, it's a tremendous responsibility, a tremendous responsibility. As Pentecost is the anniversary of the founding of the church, it is the beginning of a group called Christians who become the lights to the world. And nothing has changed in that in 2,000 years. I'd like to leave you with three very simple points about being a light. Being a light. Being a point of light. These points are very simple, but summarize what I'm trying to say here this afternoon. Point number one is quite simple. You are an example to others whether you like it or not. You are an example to others whether you like it or not. You will either encourage people or you will discourage people. If you are negative and laced with cynicism in all of your comments, then you won't be a very good example. You may attract those who feel the same way you do, but you're not going to be a point of light. You will become a collector of darkness. You know, there's a statement in 1 Peter chapter 2, talks about Christians, and what does it say? Remove all malice, all guile, and all evil speaking. Is there anyone in this audience who can claim that you've never spoken evil, you've never had guile, and you've never had malice? And yet the ultimate Christian is one who has no malice, no guile, and no evil speaking. You are an example. Whether you like it or not, you'll either be a good example or a bad example. Point number two, your example will last a long time. A negative example will require many more positives to remove from the idea or remove from the mind of another person. I learned this quite a bit in Houston. Houston was an interesting area to pastor because it had been around so long. The first pastor in Houston was Richard Armstrong. And you know, from there, everybody, you kind of go on as far as the names within the church over the years have pastored in the Houston area. But they've grown up in the church, and they've kind of intermarried. I accuse them of being the most, intertwined. In fact, I use the word incestuous church I've ever been in. But, you know, I didn't quite mean that literally. But they've all kind of intermarried in the families. There's one family in the church that has 42 members in that one congregation of their family, from, you know, sons to grandchildren and so on in one congregation. But here's the problem with that kind of a setup. People remember what you did when you were 16. And they don't forget, because I was there, and I was going to put a young man on the sermonette list, and I asked some of the elders and deacons there. Now this I said, young man, he was 40 years of age. And I said, what do you think about him giving a sermon? Oh, you don't want to do that. You'll never guess what he did when he was 16. You know, and I said, wait a minute, he's 40 years old, and you're telling me because he did what he did when he was 16, he shouldn't give a sermonette today. Oh, we still remember. There'll be people in that audience who'll still remember you put him up there. So, you know, people remember. They remember. They don't forget a negative example. And it'll take many, many positive examples to overcome that. And point number three, you control your example. No one else does. You determine your attitude. You can be in the midst of all kinds of negative things. You can be in the midst of great trials. But you still control your attitude. You can either wring your hands and cry out, or you can continue to be a point of light to others around you, no matter what your circumstances. You determine your attitude. I also find it very interesting that in the Bible, it uses the analogy of a child. You ever wonder, well, why does the Bible compare Christianity to a child, and we're to become childlike? I think we know some of the reasons why, but I'd like to read the lyrics of a song that I think exemplifies what God wants from us when He thinks of a child and when we think of a child, the way we should be when it comes to our attitude. This is a song that was I've seen various versions of it. It was written by, written as a short story and written as a song. It was actually written as a song and sung by Kenny Rogers. This goes back to probably the 1970s. But here's what the, here's the way the song goes. It's all about a young boy in baseball. It says, little boy in a baseball hat. You have to imagine this being sung. I'm not going to sing it, but I'll read it to you. A little boy in a baseball hat stands in a field with his ball and his bat. Says, I am the greatest player of them all. Puts his bat on his shoulder and tosses up his ball. And the ball goes up and the ball comes down. He swings his bat all the way around. And the world's so still you can hear the sound as the baseball falls to the ground. Now the little boy doesn't say a word. Picks up his ball. He is undeterred. He says, I am the greatest there has ever been. He grits his teeth and he tries it again. The ball goes up and the ball comes down. He swings his bat all the way around. And the world's so still you can hear the sound as the baseball falls to the ground. He makes no excuses. He shows no fear. He just closes his eyes and listens to the cheers. Little boy, he adjusts his hat, picks up his ball and stares at his bat. Says, I am the greatest the game has ever seen. The game is on the line. He gives it his all one last time. And the ball goes up and the moon so bright, swings his bat with all his might. And the world's as still can be, and the baseball falls. And that's strike three. Now it's supper time, and his mama calls. Little boy starts home with his bat and his ball. Says, I am the greatest. That is a fact. But even I didn't know I could pitch like that. The mind of a child, the positive approach to the future, is an incredible thing. God has given us a wonderful opportunity as Christians to be a point of light. Ephesians chapter 5 describes light as a destroyer of darkness. Remember what I said, darkness cannot destroy light, but light can destroy darkness. Ephesians 5, the Apostle Paul says we should walk in the light and therefore extinguish darkness. Wherever you go as a Christian, you're putting out darkness because of the light that emanates from you. It is a tremendous responsibility that God has given us. You are a point of light of the Church of God. You are a point of light 24 hours a day, wherever you may be. You can't turn off the light. When you walk into a room, when you go to work, when you go on vacation, when you go to a holy day, you are a light. When I walked into Yad Vashem, and I walked into the Children's Memorial, and I stood, it was as though you were standing out in eternity, and all of these lights are flashing. An incredible, incredible scene. 1.5 million blinking lights. Innocent children who were points of light. And I think of all of God's people around the world and all of those that I've met from, you know, the individual in the Philippines who was on the death march from Bataan and lives there in the Philippines, to Jed Tsai, who's in jail in the Philippines. And wherever God's people are, there is a light. There's a point of light. Philippians 2, verse 15 says it all. You and I, as Christians, should shine like a star in a crooked and perverse world. Tomorrow is Pentecost. We are Christians. We are points of light.